Stu.
No, I was going to talk to you about that.
Our next group of speakers is on a panel called The Many Faces of the Second Amendment. There were four panelists scheduled. Unfortunately, Michael Moore, the lead plaintiff in Moore versus Madigan, was unable to make it due to a family emergency. That's too bad because I'm sure you would have enjoyed hearing him. The upside is our current panelists have a little more time to talk. And the upside is I get to talk a little bit too, because this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. I think my dad yesterday made reference to a couple of speaking events he and I did in Buffalo to a groups of black people in a forums discussing New York's SAFE Act. It was a very interesting experience, not because I've never talked to black people before, but because I've never gone into a room where I'm the other person. Everybody there, with one exception, who was a cameraman from a local cable outlet, was black. The first thing that I said after I introduced myself and thanked the county legislator who had put the thing on was, hi, I'm Peggy Tartaro, and I live 15 minutes away from this library. This library that was designed by one of the leading black architects in America, whose son I went to grammar school with. My office is 10 minutes away from this building. So I wanted to tell them that immediately that I had something in common with them, that I had not just come there, to expound and to leave. I got a big laugh. You should never say you got a big laugh and then tell the same joke, because then if you don't get the laugh, it's bad. But I said, when we're talking about things, we saw the Vice President of the United States say that he told his wife she should just get a shotgun and she should go out on the balcony and shoot it off and help would come. And I said, I don't know about you people, but I don't live at Downton Abbey. There's not going to be the faithful family retainer come up to the house tugging his forelock and say, oh, Miss Peggy, can I help you? Can I save you from the poachers or the bad guys? And you want to use common language. Everybody in that room, even if they'd never seen Downton Abbey, knew what I was talking about, rich English people. even if they had only the vaguest notion, I was putting Joe Biden over there with the clueless Brits, and I was putting myself in the same boat as those folks. As it turned out, it wasn't really a tough crowd because everybody pretty much was pro-gun, but they were not necessarily pro-gun in the same way that we're pro-gun. There was a gentleman who came up to me afterwards and talking to me, and I was, kind of mesmerized because he was wearing an Obama button. And, there's no way Obama's getting elected to anything again because, it's over soon. But that shows his intensity, his identification with Obama, but he and I had common ground on the gun issue. I would venture to guess that the majority of those people in that room that night were registered Democrats. I'm a registered Democrat. I live in a city in which if you do not vote in the Democratic primary, you might as well not vote. That doesn't mean I vote Democrat all the time, but if I want to have any kind of influence, I better be able to vote in the Democratic primary. So it's nice to say, you know, oh, I'd really like to be in the Libertarian Party or the Working Family Party, or in New York State we have pretty much a party for everything. You know, we have an official Liberal Party of New York. We have an official Conservative Party, in addition to Republican and Democrat. So, you know, I had common ground with these people. I wasn't just coming to preach. And I would advise you, to accept all, pretty much every invitation that you get, to make yourself available to be invited. And when you get there, or actually before you get there, to do some hard thinking about what you have in common with people, and to start talking about that to begin with. Most of those people at that meeting a few months ago, you know, they'll probably vote for Andrew Cuomo if he runs for governor again. Whether they'd vote for him for president, I don't know, because we got Hillary, too. You know, so you're not always going to make a connection. But this meeting of all black faces in an inner city, in one of the poorest cities in the country, in one of the most crime-ridden cities in the country, did make it onto cable news. And nobody had pitchforks. Nobody was arguing with me. Nobody was stomping out of the room and saying, you know, she's crazy. So that's important. A good way to think about it is like those old World War II movies where they'd have the foxhole and there'd be, you know, the guy from Brooklyn and the guy from the big city and the southern guy and the person that inexplicably played the harmonica in the foxhole. There was a reason that those were crafted that way. And yes, we look at it now and we think it's a little ham-handed and a little hokey, but there were two reasons to do it. When you went to the movies, if you saw somebody that looked more like you, you were appreciative. But it was also propaganda, pure and simple. Here's all these folks in trouble together. And, you know, by gum, they may look different and they may sound different, but they are all Americans. And, you know, that's what you've got to do. You've got to find a good starting place. You got to look for those areas in which you have common ground. And you have to remember that you are not always going to make converts to your brand. But all the time that you can spend with other folks, all the time that you can create these connections, is all to the good. As I say, most of those folks are going to vote a state, straight Democratic line from now until doomsday. But, when they show up or they make a face when they have a meeting with an Andrew Cuomo that, you know, he crafts so he's, you know, in the middle of, the inner city, that makes a difference, and you never know who's going to be on our side. I like to assume that they're all on our side and go from there rather than the other way around. And now I'm going to let my official panelists talk for 10 minutes each, and we'll start with Charles.
Thank you. My name is Charles Heller. I'm the Executive Director of Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Many of you are familiar with our organization. Is there any of you who are not? Okay, a couple. It was started 25 years ago by a man named Aaron Zellman. Aaron left us in 2010, built a great organization, and JPFO takes some positions that most other organizations cannot do. For instance, and I'm going to be a little facetious, but it has a point. I'm not just saying it for a laugh from the audience. By the way, I believe the brevity is the soul of wit. Therefore, I'm going to just get right past this. I believe that humor is important in addressing people. So let's get that out of the way. On a count of 3, 2, 1, I just want you all to laugh. 3, 2, 1, laugh. See? All right, that part's over. Aaron began to take positions that other people cannot do. For instance, he referred to people, Jewish people who are anti-gun, as bagel brains. Now, most of you, if you said that, it would be taken as an anti-Semitic remark. But it comes from Rabbi David Ben-Dori, the rabbinic director of JPFO. You can quote Rabbi Ben-Dori, and you are not being anti-Semitic. You are being an accurate reporter of a fact. And that, as Mr. Gould said, Peter J. Gould said, David Capel yesterday said so accurately, we have to be very careful that we do not exceed fact. And so when you quote other people, we have a tool. And Tom, could you bring me that DVD that I left over there? I'd really appreciate it. Thanks. We have some tools that you can use, and here's what I'd like you to do. I'm going to actually encourage you to adopt an Alinsky tactic, because if you read Rules for Radicals and you apply some of the principles for moral good as opposed to more moral evil, which is some of what he promoted, but thank you. If you use some of the principles in there, and one of the principles is find a target and freeze it. I'm going to say find a target and warm it. And what I'm going to suggest you to do, you know, if you want to see more people in here, if you will practice adoption, adopt one person that you could bring to GRPC in Chicago, or adopt one person that you could convert away from being anti-freedom. And Alan Corwin is so right about, I even call it Corwinizing the language. And it's, you're not pro-gun. You're pro-rights. Because a person can be pro-gun or anti-gun. It's just as valid a point. I mean, you just have a different opinion. But if you're pro-rights, you're a civil rights activist. And if you're anti-rights, what are you? You're a bigot if you're anti-rights. And so you legitimately call people an anti-rights bigot when they're prejudiced. They make a judgment in advance of fact is prejudiced. And when they're prejudiced against your rights, you simply point that out. But you can't do it with animus. You have to do it with love. And the same thing is true. I was interviewed on the radio yesterday in my hometown. And John C., the guy that was interviewing me, said he mentioned the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. And I said to him, John, we have to be careful with phrases like that. Because I'm on the same radio station as him. I can talk to him as a colleague. I said, John, as broadcasters, we have to be careful. That's a loaded phrase. And I explain why. So what I want to encourage you to do is who here is familiar with BNI, Business Networking International? Anybody heard of it? They have, it's a large, international group of people that depends on the model of, gathering people together so that they know, like, and trust them. I'm going to encourage you to find a person who, instead of freezing, or several people, who you can warm a little bit to our way of looking at things. And the way you do it is by finding commonality, by finding some commonality in of interest, and not using any harsh terms that put them off. It's like teaching a new person to shoot. I know guys that do this. They take their gal friend and they take them to the range and they put a 12 gauge in their hand. And the poor person is terribly put off by the noise and the sound and the recoil of the instrument. No, start them with a 22. If they're a kid, start them with an air gun. So they get that tremendous feeling of accomplishment. And that's what I want you to promote in the other person. I want you to promote a seed of empowerment to them. I want you to make it their idea to do some good. Because I tell you what folks want. People want to make a difference. And what you can offer them is a chance to make a difference. What you can offer them is some empowerment. You can do it in a lot of ways. You can empower them to be a little bit more responsible. Are they going to become an, are they going to develop an arsenal? Probably not. But you can at least get them to own a .22. Because once they do, once they own one firearm, from going from 0 to 1 is the biggest change. Going from 1 to 34 is not a big deal. Getting them to crew-served weapons is an accomplishment. I'll give you that, okay? But we there you go. We're not there yet. Most of us, if we could just get them into a Ruger Mark II or a Browning Buck Mark or a Smith & Wesson 422, it would be a tremendous leap forward, right? It would be that footprint on the moon. That's what it would be. And that's what I want to encourage you to do. Now, we have some tools for you to do that. I sound like Homer Simpson, don't I? Tools. We have, and I don't even watch television. And that's, by the way, the impression that media makes. I don't even have TV service, but we all know who Homer Simpson is.
And I look a little.
Anyway. Too much information. We have some tools at JPFO you can use to help people, to make a difference in people's lives. And I'm not up here to sell materials. I'm up here to tell you about tools of empowerment. But this is a video, we call it Triple Play. This has on it No Guns for Negroes, No Guns for Jews, and 2A for the USA. No Guns for Negroes is a DVD we made with the people from the Congress of Racial Equality. And if you have black friends, once you scrape them off the ceiling because of the title, and you explain it was made with the folks from the Congress of Racial Equality, it is a tremendous tool. You don't have to be the person to make the convincing argument to your friends. You can sit them down and watch this movie with them, and it will change hearts and minds. That's number one. No Guns for Jews. If you have Jewish friends, sit them down and... Don't serve pork. And sit them down and watch the movie with them. Okay? And when you do that, this will make emotional arguments that you can never do. Because you can't make an argument that's that emotional, but a movie can. That's the power of the tools you can use with them. We also have a magnificent movie, Innocence Betrayed, which is the history of gun control in the 20th century. And if you can sit people down and if you can hold a showing of that movie, you can change hearts and minds. You can take a community center, you put 50 or 60 people in it, serve some light refreshment and put on the movie, and you will change hearts and minds. And the next thing is, once you have somebody open to it, you now have to teach a couple people, take them to the range, teach them the butterfly. Everybody know the butterfly, how you can teach a non-gun person with about 6 steps how to hold a gun? About, if you do that, it's called the butterfly. Gary Marbot taught it to me a few GRPCs ago. If you teach people the butterfly, you will teach them the beginnings of safety with a tool of personal empowerment, and it will make a difference. So those are all things that you can do. And create a culture of empowerment. I call it, how many in here have got a multi-tool on them? All right? Everybody should, respectfully. I call it Leatherman sells them that you can take on an airliner. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They sure do. And create the culture of empowerment. I call it a Leatherman society. Create the culture in people that makes them want to have one of these so that they can be self-sufficient. Not so that they can go out and change the world, just so they can take care of themselves. If you create that culture in their cup, you will change hearts and minds. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Charles. He told me not to shout into the microphone. He told me not to shout into the microphone. So I'm going to bring our friend Doug Ritter up to talk to you a little bit about knife rights. Doug.
Thank you, Peggy. 4 years ago, I stood here at GRPC, our first GRPC, and declared that knife rights was the second front in the defense of our Second Amendment. 4 years ago, I told you that the Second Amendment doesn't say firearms, it says arms. 4 years ago, I told you that it was our Second Amendment, too. 4 years ago, thank you. 4 years ago, I received a great deal of support, but a lot of folks told me I was just a wee bit nuts. Many in the knife industry told me that we would not succeed, that I was more than just a wee bit nuts. I was totally out of my mind. Well, after 4 years, people are starting to believe. Knife rights is rewriting knife law in America. In just 4 years, we have passed 12 pro-knife bills in 11 states. And oh, by the way, we can take credit for defeating 4 anti-knife bills. So call that 4 years and 16 legislative victories. It ain't bragging if it's true. Every one of those victories is a victory for the Second Amendment, because it's our Second Amendment too. This year has been an extraordinary successful one for knife rights. We passed pro-knife bills in 5 states, Alaska, Indiana, Texas, Tennessee, and right here in Texas. It hasn't always been easy, and there's a lesson in here for all of us. Persistence pays. Our success in Alaska, Indiana, and Kansas were the culmination of 2 solid years of work. It doesn't always happen overnight. Failing to pass legislation only means you come back smarter and harder the next time around. Protecting our Second Amendment calls for nothing less. In New York City, our federal civil rights lawsuit against the city and District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. must have really pissed off some folks who are so arrogant that they think they make the law. We've had the city up against the ropes for 2 years, with every ruling from 2 separate federal court judges going our way. But just a few months ago, our case was inexplicably reassigned to an Obama appointee. On Tuesday, the judge ruled that the plaintiffs in our case, who have been falsely arrested or threatened with arrest over common pocket knives, do not have standing to sue, in part because the case documents don't identify the specific knives that would be illegal under New York City's interpretation of the state penal code. The trouble is, it's nearly impossible for them under New York's haphazard and inconsistent approach, which is the very basis, the whole point of our lawsuit. Even the DA has admitted that different specimens of the exact same make and model of knife can be both legal and illegal. How can that be? So here we have a situation where we're suing because we can't know for certainty what is legal and what is banned, yet the judge is saying we don't have the standing to sue precisely because we haven't identified what's legal or banned in our court papers. That is simply absurd. Needless to say, we are appealing this absurd ruling. Knife rights will continue to fight in New York City with everything we've got. We will not bow to arrogant and lawless bureaucrats. I still get calls every week from innocent citizens whose lives have been turned upside down simply because they're carrying a common tool, a common pocket knife. Thousands have been arrested on bogus illegal knife charges. And of particular interest to many of you in this room, you should know that gun owners who have been arrested on one of these bogus knife charges have their guns confiscated, and many of them still have not gotten them back, even after the charges are dismissed. We cannot, we must not, let New York City succeed in their absurd redefinition of what a gravity knife is to cover the most common pocket knives sold in America today, one-hand opening pocket knives. If they succeed, it will become a model for all left-leaning cities in America. Ultimately, that leads to a very bad end for every believer in the Second Amendment. We cannot let that happen. Liberal bureaucrats and corrupt politicians from Blueburn Town may be gloating today, but they won't be laughing when we ultimately prevail. It's going to be a long road, but we're quite willing to walk it. We need your support now more than ever. We are delivering on our promise of a sharper future for all Americans. Please help support Knife Rights. Become a member. Spread the word. Knife Rights is the second front in defense of our Second Amendment. We are rewriting knife law in America, and you can bet your bottom dollar we are not anywhere near done. Just wait and see what comes next. And now I get to the part that I know a number of you from Texas are waiting for. Because we can, because we changed the knife law in Texas, we're going to give away a switchblade. And if you would like to pull one of those tickets out, must be present to win. Is Edwin Lee here? There he is. Congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Doug. And now we'll bring up the Reverend Tony Winfield. Tony?
Good morning. I'm going to give a short bio on how I got involved in the pro-gun movement. I went to seminary in Massachusetts, and then I became a federal correction officer as I was interning as a minister. And an African-American friend of mine, I mentioned that because people said, oh, black people don't like the NRA. He told me, another officer, join the NRA, good group. Okay, I joined it. I started reading The American Rifleman. And see, when you go to seminary and you get a postgraduate degree, you know how to do research. So I checked everything the NRA said, and it was true. I said, wow, these guys know what they're talking about. This is really good stuff here. So I was very pleased with that. Then I realized the media had an anti-gun agenda, and New York Newsday said that the Second Amendment does not guarantee the right to bear arms and so forth. So innocently, I started sending them information. I took the information from the NRA, and I made 7 manila envelope packets of good research and sent it to the publisher and 6 other editors, and I said, do not send me any information quoting Handgun Control Incorporated about how gun control works over there so it can work over here. And he did exactly what I told him not to do. A junior editor wrote me back and then made stupid comments. You see, I thought that the media was just sincerely wrong and that I was going to enlighten them and they were going to have an epiphany. And I really did. And thank you, Reverend Winfield. We didn't know this. And the guy writes me back, stupid letter. Stupid. How come the NRA is not fighting on the federal level and blah, 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 and this. I had a higher view of people in the media until I got this letter. And I said, these people are not as smart as I thought they were. I said to myself, so anyway, I wrote them back. I said, you did exactly what I told you not to do. Anyway, fast forward. I wrote a booklet called Self-Defense in the Bible in the 1990s, self-published book. The gun lobby liked it, drew attention to me. And people find it interesting when you're a minister and you're not anti-gun. And I explained to them, if you look in the Bible, you see there's no pacifism in the Bible. The Israelites fought back. And Christ told his disciples to carry swords. And people didn't know that. I said, the sword has been replaced by the handgun. And, so people, wow, that makes sense, and so forth. So anyway, I wound up on television in 1990s, on cable television. And I went up against lawyers. I was scared at first. Wow, this is a law professor. I'm just a minister. After 2 minutes of talking to this woman, I said, this is going to be easy. They don't know what they're talking about. They just don't. And I found it very easy. I even went against a lawyer from Handgun Control Incorporated, and he had to admit that the waiting period height in California, he said, we saved 6,000 lives because of the waiting period. So I said, did those people go to jail who lied on the application? He said, no. I said, then you didn't really protect society. He admitted, he said, we have to try harder. But the bottom line was, I found out the media, they have an agenda, surprise, surprise, and I was the one who had an epiphany about them. I said, these guys here don't know what they're talking about, and so forth. I have had opportunity to educate people and walk them through the pro-gun side of the story. And then being a black person, I was able to talk to people about the history of gun control. During Reconstruction, they passed laws banning guns and registration lists. The first registration list they passed was to disarm black people during Reconstruction. And a lot of people didn't know that. They still don't know that today. They don't know that, and they find it interesting. I said, this is why we don't like registration lists. Ironically, we got David Dinkins in New York. Yeah, he used the registration list against people owned military rifles. He did that after the media said it would never do that in 1960. So I had a lot of stuff to share these people with them, and I wound up embarrassing some of them too because they knew I was with the NRA, and the assistant director of personnel approached me in an auditorium one time at the hospital. He said, "Hey, Rev, you with the NRA, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You know that according to Michael Moore, the NRA and the KKK were aligned at one time?" And he saw me bristle. He said, calm down, Rev. Went on the internet, got some information from our good friend David Kopel, 7-page article rebutting Bowling for Columbine. The guy saw me next time. He ducked. He made a fool out of himself. He just made a fool out of himself. Now, here's where something personal happened to me involving carrying a gun. You know, we say 2 million people a year defend themselves without firing a shot. A lot of studies on that, right? Here I am in the January of 1994, winter, and I went to the 7-Eleven store in the evening, and I'm walking down the street. I see a guy coming, a young man. He makes a right turn. We both had on wool hats. Walking the same direction. Then I realize I forgot my money. I turn around to go back to my house. Then I hear somebody screaming. I turn and look around. The kid saw me, and he figured I scared that old guy because he changed directions. He started coming toward me. Now, he didn't know that I had my girlfriend with me, Mrs. Glock. Okay? Joined to my hip. Glock 23. I love them. He crosses the street, lowers his shoulder, and he rams me. Then he pretends he's crazy. So I was supposed to say, what do you want? Give me your money. He had his head down, pulled out my Glock, and I clocked him with the Glock. Right over here. He jumped back. I said, kid, I'll blow you away. Right? I'll blow you away. His friend comes across the street. He puts his hands up. So what had happened, he saw an opportunity. His friend, he's walking toward his friend. His friend probably didn't know why he crossed the street. And he sees me, holding his friend at gunpoint. He puts his hand up. I had to think fast. I said, you know what? There's two guys against one. Suppose the police believe them. Suppose they take my gun. Suppose they arrest me. So I said, I'm going to walk away from this. And I decided to do that. He followed me, daring me to shoot him because he saw I wasn't going to shoot him, put on a big front for his friend and yelling at me, shoot me, I want to die and stuff. And I know where you live. That scared me. I know where you live, Russell. I made sure I didn't go back in my building. So I was thinking real smart and fast. He stopped following me. I go around the block back into my apartment. And I told my wife, first thing he said, you shot him, didn't you? You shot him. I said, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. You did. You did shoot him. I said, no, I didn't shoot him. You did. You did. My daughter was there. 10 years old. Smiling. Smile. I got a crazy pistol packing preacher father. I know she was probably thinking that and so forth. But to make a long story short, you see, we have a joke. When you're middle-aged and you're going to fight somebody 17, you better get them in 2 minutes. If it goes over two, you're gonna lose the fight. But it's better if you have a gun, okay? I used to sleep with Mrs. Glock under the pillow. My wife allowed it, okay? One thing I like about having a gun under the pillow, point in a safe direction now. Guys, when you reach out to touch your gun will never push your hand away. Okay? Okay? You get my drift? Okay. But I'm a firm believer in self-defense because I can argue that's biblical. And I can argue history. And people do listen. People listen. But another epiphany I had was this whole thing about race pride. I had to learn to stop being idealistic, thinking that you just show the truth and people will repent and change and believe. No, they have an agenda. There's also a thing called racial pride. The whole thing with Barack Obama, I tried to tell him what he was about, even not about guns, that he was a socialist, he was anti-Judeo-Christian and so forth, thinking that they were going to say, oh, I can't vote for him, and they went ahead and did it. That was an epiphany for me. The truth doesn't matter to a lot of people. It doesn't. They have the agenda. You can present it to them, but most of the time, it's not going to work. And it's not just black people. Because I even had Jewish people say, a woman called up Rush Limbaugh and said, I'm Jewish, Orthodox, and I was appalled. My rabbi said, we don't agree with Lieberman morally, he's for abortion, we're not, but it would be good for Jewish people if he became vice president. And that's, ethnic pride is very strong. It really is. So I had to look at that and had to learn to accept that you can present the truth and the change is not going to happen at all, or it's going to be slow. It's going to be slow. So that was my difficulty. But I am in the process now of rewriting the book. Long overdue. My daughter's been getting on me. Rewrite the book, Daddy. Got more material and so forth. I'm going to do it soon. I do have a blog still in progress, pistolpackingpreacher.com. Okay. It needs to be reworked. But I am very proud to be part of this movement, just as I was a proud Marine serving my country. Fought in Vietnam and so forth. Now I'm here with you, and we share the same agenda. We're fighting for freedom, defending the Constitution, and the right to bear arms. God bless you all, and God bless America.